Welcome to Circuit Break from Macrofab, a weekly show about all things engineering, DIY projects, manufacturing, industry news, and Apple Mega 2E projects. We're your hosts, electrical engineers Parker Dillman
and Stephen Craig,
and this is episode 420, Blaze It. Circuit Break from Macrofab.
Hey, Circuit Breakers, we have an announcement. We are running an electronic design contest on our community forums, and the theme is food devices. Go to forum.macrofab.com to find out more information about the contest and how to enter. For prizes, there's over $5,000 in cash, free prototyping services through Macrofab, and the most important thing, trophies to show that your design was one of the best entered. There will be a link in the show notes on where to find more information about the contest and how to enter. Our guest this week is James Lewis, aka Bald Engineer, freelance electronics content creator. You might recognize James from the YouTube channels Add Ohms and Workbench Wednesdays from Element 14. His interests include talking too much about capacitors, repairing vintage computers, and making unique PCBs that go into poorly designed 3D printed enclosures.
I'm going to guess that's going to be the topic of this one.
It's very close.
James has been on the show a few times now, including episode 114, where he joined to talk to us about ceramic capacitors. He also joined in episode 222 to discuss testing and validating PCB assembly design. And more recently, episode 411, where we discussed reliability and component aging effects. So welcome back, James.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize this is the fourth time.
And the last time was just a handful of weeks ago.
Yeah, that's crazy.
I think you were one of the first people, James, on our podcast when we renamed our podcast.
That sounds right. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember that because I remember listening to the 400, number 400, and I was thinking, okay, I have to remember there's a new name now.
So last time we talked about component aging effects, we're kind of diving completely off track from what we normally talk about with you, James, which is, you know, components and that kind of stuff. But we're going to talk about a project that you've been working on for a long time.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, depending on how you count, either 5 or 3 years.
So what is the project?
So I call the project the Mega 2E. I took a chip out of the Apple II GS called the Mega 2, which has all of the logic of the previous generations of Apple II computers on a single chip. And I built a functional computer around that chip.
So before we dive more into that project, I want to know why the Apple, because I didn't grow up with Apple computers at all. I'm actually too young for at least the Apple II. Why is the Apple II so revered in vintage computing space?
You know, that's a good question. And I think it's a different answer for different people. For me, The Apple II was, I was thinking about this a while ago. When I was in elementary school, I went to four elementary schools in two states and three or four cities. And so I saw a lot of different schools. And the one constant in every single one of those classrooms was an Apple II computer. You know, at the time, being a kid, that just seemed totally normal, right? That was the computer at school, and that was just the way it was. And so for me, there's a lot of nostalgia because it was really the first computer I really learned to use. But then as an adult, I feel like a lot of times people look at vintage computers because they remember the video games. And I know I'm going to offend some Apple II fans, but most of the games on the Apple II are not very good. You know, if you like compare it to like what's available on the Commodore 64, there's a big difference in especially graphics quality. And I will try to backpedal a little bit. There are good games on the Apple II, but that's not why I love the platform. I like it because from a hardware engineer's perspective, it is a fantastic piece of engineering because it is an extremely open design and it has a ton of clever tricks. So it's just really fun to understand how the computer works or try to understand how it works.
I'm curious, can you go a little bit more into when you say extremely open, what do you mean by that?
Yeah, so the very first Apple II, it came out in like 1977. It had about 80 chips on the entire design. Other than the ROMs, everything was off the shelf. There were no custom chips. And then outside of the CPU, the keyboard controller, a couple of 555s, and the ROMs, everything on that board is a 7400 series logic chip. And so there's two aspects to it. First, if you had no documentation, you could literally figure out what the circuit looks like just because it's right there. But like computers in the early 80s, there was tons of published documentation on how it was designed, how it was built. And then things like the ROM are completely documented. Even back then, when you bought like the first Apple II, you got a listing of the ROM along with it. And so there were no secrets about the Apple II, which, by the way, is also why there were so many clones, because they basically sold you a copy of how to build the computer with every computer.
So part of it was just not a lot of custom silicon inside of it.
Yeah, yeah. So if you look at like the Apple II and then the Apple IIe, which, by the way, the E does not stand for enhanced, because there is also the enhanced Apple IIe, just to make it more confusing.
E squared.
Yeah. I think E actually might have meant, I think they actually meant extend it, because it's fully backward compatible with everything the Apple II and II Plus did, but it added some capabilities as well. But that was also the first computer where they took a lot of that logic and integrated it into four or five ASICs. And even then, one of the ASICs is just a PAL or a GAL, a gate array logic chip that's masked. And then the others are really just implementations of the 7400 series logics. And so they're just integration chips. If you compare that to, say, like a Commodore 64 at the time, Commodore never had a discrete version of their computer. There was always a handful of custom chips inside, like the PLA, for example, for the memory controller. And then you could argue some of the other silicon was somewhat custom as well, because, I mean, MOS did a lot of the chips for them. And so it wasn't quite as open, because there wasn't like a reference for what that chip design was. Whereas with the Apple II and the Apple IIe, there was essentially documentation for all of that.
Yeah, we had Bill Hurd on, who worked on Commodore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's great.
And he talked about working on the Commodore and where they had actually, they can go literally downstairs and build custom chips.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's probably where, I bet you Apple didn't have a chip fab underneath their basement, basically, to be able to do that.
Garage.
Yeah, a garage.
Yeah, actually, they basically did everything with VLSI, the company. Yeah, they didn't have that kind of capability. And really none of the computer companies, there probably was another, but I mean, that was something that was super unique to Commodore, was that, yeah, they could get custom stuff done. And yeah.
So yeah, you're not joking. I'm actually looking at the schematics right now for it. And these schematics are kind of brutal to visualize in your head, because there's just so much stuff going around, but it's just a whole bunch of 7400 series chips that I grabbed a random one, threw it into Google. You can still buy it from Texas Instruments right now.
Yeah. And by the way, so a lot of the, especially like anything in the, like in the Apple II era, a lot of the Apple II and II Plus, a lot of it's LS series, which is actually harder and harder to buy today. But after the II and II Plus, almost everything was HC. And so there's, if that's not available, there's a modern equivalent. And then as the computers went along later, it started to get to the really high speed stuff, because they couldn't do it faster. And because it was some kind of condition where they needed silicon that was faster than they could do in the custom chips. And by the way, if I can plug something real quick, I do have a project on GitHub called Bit Preserve. And it's a repository where people can contribute vintage computer schematics redrawn in KiCad. And so there's an Apple II Plus design that I actually just fixed up the other day. The 2GS is in there for obvious reasons. The 2E was done by a friend of mine. And then there's a Commodore, Tandy, a bunch of other retro computers as well.
Oh, that's awesome. Out of curiosity, is someone going through and validating and checking those?
Nope.
Okay, well, they're up there. Just keep that in mind, I suppose.
Yeah, and what I'll say there is, like, the way I use it is, if I'm trying to look up something really quick, it's a lot easier to do it with the KiCad version of the schematic, or even if there's a PDF of it, it's just a lot easier to read. But I always have the original right next to it, because it's like, okay, if I find the thing I'm looking for, I make sure on the original that they sort of match, because, yeah, there's just not a good way to validate those.
Yeah, because these schematics I have pulled up right here, let me just call them classic schematics, where the page, where they scanned them, the pages have creases where the going through chips or chips are off the page, or you have to kind of print it out and tie them all together.
When I started doing the Bit Preserve project, I had a ton of people ask me, well, why don't you just use like OpenCV and OCR, the existing scans? And I'm like, I can't read them. So I don't know how to write code to read them.
Right.
Yeah. The I remember poring over old Atari 2600 and 7800 schematics. They're very similar. Yeah, that's actually another thing. Atari had their own custom silicon then.
Mm-hmm.
So they were more, I guess they're kind of in between Commodore and the Apple series computers then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's how I view it. And so backing way up, you know, that's, to me, that's why the Apple II is my favorite, is simply because from a hardware designer perspective, it's, I can look at it and there's no secrets. It's like, here's the design, right? And I think that's just super cool. Like, that just blows me away.
So on the project, what drove you to say, I want to take this and run with this project and make the Mega 2E?
So here's what happened. So, and that's why I say this was like 5 or 6 years ago. I was like, you know what? I never owned an Apple II, but I remembered using them in school, like I was talking about before. And so I was like, I'm going to buy an Apple II GS so that I can experience the Apple II again. And I just want to point out that when I got it, I couldn't even remember how to reset it. Like it's like the command or Apple control, the power button or reset. And I didn't remember that sequence at all. I didn't know the difference between basic and the monitor. I didn't even know that AppleSoft was basic. Like, I thought that was something else. And I didn't know how to load anything off of floppy drives. I couldn't remember how to do any of that stuff. And so I was like, okay, I want to take this approach of, okay, I just bought this computer. Let me go find the manuals online so that I can read about how to use it, right? And I found this one called the Hardware Reference Guide. I was like, hey, I like the name of that. So I started reading that. And in one of the sections, it talks about this Mega 2 chip. And it says, the Apple II GS contains a Mega 2, which has all of the logic of an Apple IIe. And all you need to add is RAM, ROM, and you would have a fully functional Apple IIe. And so I was like, all right, so I wonder if I can do that. And I want to point out, because, and for people that don't know the 2GS architecture, this may not matter as much, but for some people that are familiar with the 2GS, so the 2GS was a 16-bit computer that was fully backward compatible with all of Apple's Apple II 8-bit software. And even their own documentation, and it's funny because I found even earlier versions where this is a little more heavy-handed, Apple tried to imply that the Mega 2 is why the 2GS was backward compatible, when in reality, the 2GS uses the Mega 2 for the Apple II video modes and as an IO controller. When software runs on the 2GS, the 2GS, its own chipset and ROM is actually doing the emulation. It turns on and acts like an Apple II. Software has to tell it to turn into a 2GS. And so when I learned that, I got even more interested in the project because I realized at that point, even the 2GS wasn't using this Mega 2 chip for its intended purpose. And Apple never built a computer around the Mega 2. They did license it to Tiger Electronics, who did make a prototype computer, but it never got out of test marketing.
Hmm. So that exists somewhere?
Yeah, there's a handful that exist. There's a person in the Apple II community that kind of shared some information with me because he has one. And at first I was like, oh no, I committed the sin of saying I've done the world's first thing. And then I'm like, oh, here's this thing that is almost what I did. And I was talking to him and he's like, you got to understand it's all Bodge wires and the keyboard bounces. Like, you can't even type on it. So it's not really functional.
It was really like the first stab. And then there was like, kill the project.
It's alpha.
Yeah. Yeah, and I have different stories on why it was killed, but the reality is there's only a handful of these devices in the world.
So I kind of already know the answer to this, so maybe this is a tongue-in-cheek question. But the Mega chip, all it takes is RAM, ROM, and maybe some glue logic, and then everything works, right?
Oh my gosh, it's so funny. In my mind, I thought I was going to make a breakout board for the Mega 2, which is a 84-pin PLCC, so plastic lead chip carrier, I think. I can't remember what the CC, but the cool thing about that package, if you're not familiar with it, is it can either be surface mount or it can go into a socket. And so I kind of wish more packages were still like that, but it's kind of a cool package in that regard. But it's 84.
When you see that on a board, you're like, that circuit board's old. That's like, has that old
look. I love those chips. I miss them.
Yeah.
You know what? And inserting those chips into the socket is one of the most satisfying things you can do, because you get that scratch and then this nice clunk. I love doing it.
When I first started in electronics, though, I was very scared of those. Just how much force it takes to pull something out or push something in, you're like, I am going to break this.
Yeah. Funny story about that. So the Mega 2 has 84 pins. One pin is VCC, two pins are ground, and the rest are functions.
For the whole thing?
For the whole thing.
Wow.
And on one of my Mega 2s, I damaged one of the ground pins, and I was like, you've got to be kidding me. Like, how lucky did I get that the only pin I damaged has a copy?
And well, that's old. Were those chips CMOS or were they just NOS chips?
You know, I don't know.
Because the old Atari stuff was all just NOS because they were even cheaper to just build. So CMOS, you know, you have N and P type, and then so like NOS was like you only had one type.
Yeah. So I came across one reference that talked about. So every reference I found talked about it as CMOS, but I feel like that was also kind of a time when CMOS was still getting used for either. But there was one comment about how, like in, maybe it was in the 2E, or no. It's with the Mega 2 and the way that it deals with slots. Its edge rates are a little bit slower than what the previous generation of Apple computers had. And one of the explanations was that the chip process used is not as fast as a 74HC series. But from my measurements, I mean, they're pretty close. It's like, you know, nanoseconds difference. But it was enough that, okay, if you had a really tight timing consideration, you might be off. So my guess is it's CMOS, but I don't know for sure.
The big thing was power consumption difference. But when back then, you know, it didn't matter. So
Yeah, actually, so, you know, this whole thing, so the PLCC and then the CPU, the ROM, the EEPROM, and then 128K of dynamic RAM, it only draws about 250 milliamps total, which really blows me away.
That was what I was about to ask, because through one power pin, it's like, how much is it trying to pull through that one pin to power up?
Yeah, I would say it's probably on the order of 150 to 200 milliamps, and then the rest of the design draws the rest.
That's nothing.
But yeah. It's shockingly low. It's so low because, so I used a Raspberry Pi Pico. No, sorry. Let me back up. I used RP2040s, the Raspberry Pi microcontroller. I used two of them because they have the PIO or the programmable IOs, which allow you to do a lot of really cool things that you can't generally do with a microcontroller's GPIO pins. And at one point I was like, well, why don't I use PALs or programmable array logic chips to do some of the stuff, some of the decoding that I need. And those chips draw 200 milliamps by themselves. Hmm. I was like, wait a minute, I'm going to double the current consumption by adding a single chip. It's like, wait, that's just mind boggling.
Well, now that you brought up the Pi chips, let's talk a little bit about the architecture, because stepping back, you were just mentioning the idea was to make this into a kind of a breakout board. But what did it end up becoming?
Ah, yeah. Good point. So, yeah. So back, I thought, OK, I'm going to make a breakout board. And I did design the PCB, and I swear I had it fabbed, but I can't find it anywhere. So maybe I didn't actually get it built. But I was looking at it, and I was like, wait, I'm going to have to hook up 80 jumper wires to this thing. It's like, I didn't think this through. And so then I came up with a design where I put the Mega, RAM, basically what I thought were the building blocks I needed, the Mega, RAM, ROM, and video circuit. And so I thought it was the minimum I thought I would need to make a bootable computer. And after a lot of frustration, I got that to boot and then immediately crash. And it crashed because there was no keyboard controller. And so that's the first lie, is that the Mega 2 needs a keyboard controller in order to work. Without something to drive the data bus when keyboard accesses happen, bad things happen. Hmm. So yeah, so that's how the architecture started to build up, is it's like, okay, so now I know what the minimum blocks are to get the thing to boot, but then to make it work, I need it something to act like a keyboard. And that's where it was like, originally I was thinking to do something like with a PAL chip and decode the keyboard stuff and blah, blah, blah. And then instead I decided I'd use the Pi Pico or the RP2040, since I could have it, its IO is fast enough to watch the bus and drive the data bus when it's appropriate.
I'm a little bit curious, what's unique about the 2040? I haven't dug too much into them. Why'd you end up picking those?
So the number one reason was, this was all during the lockdown time period where we had the component shortage. So the number one reason is they were really easy to get. So that was,
I love it.
It was like, okay, I can get this chip. What can I do with it?
I wonder how many products were developed in that year time span, that was number one reason.
Yeah, actually, it was like I was doing a power supply design and somebody's like, well, this is a terrible chip. Why would you ever use this? I'm like, I can get them. I just there's nothing else available. That's it.
And honestly, they were a great price.
Yeah, yeah. So the RP2040, the thing that makes it special is that its I/O pins have their own state machine. And so you get, it's a 9 instruction set. You get 32 instructions and you can basically, for example, you can shift in all 32 IOs in a single clock, and then you can shift those and then DMA those into RAM on the next clock. Maybe it's like 2 clocks later without using the CPU. It's all asynchronous to whatever the ARM core is doing. And so like in my case, I used those GPIOs to be watching the control signals, which were clocked at about 1 megahertz. And then I had to respond and put 8 bits on the data bus within 200 nanoseconds, which is almost impossible to do with, say, like an interrupt on a regular microcontroller. And so that's what makes it unique, is they've got these little state machines that you can program independent of the ARM core. And that state machine can run those instructions at like 100 megahertz or so. And so they can emulate, you can use them to pretend like they are 7400 series logic in a lot of cases, because they've got plenty of time to think about what they're doing.
Huh, I did not know that. So it's almost like little, really, really stripped down FPGA on every pin capability.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the way I look at it is it's basically you're writing assembler for the GPIO pins. And so I want to be careful because there's not a lot of decode logic that you can do. Like, for example, there's no if statement. And so there's some limit. The PIO is really meant to help make serial bus protocols, like custom protocols. So like, you know, you've got a spy implementation that you want to do that's kind of weird. It can handle all that for you. And then all you care about on the code side is, does data show up in the RAM or not, right?
Which is exactly what you used it for, basically. Like a bus sniffer to do things.
Yeah, actually, for the video, that's exactly what we did. So we went from, I was going to breadboard this thing, which was not possible. And then I built up a couple of boards that I thought was the simplified design. And then I ended up with a ton, I mean, just ton of fly wires. And, you know, I mean, this is it's an 8-bit computer. So 16 bits for the address bus, 8 bits for the data bus, a couple of signals for the clocks. And then I had these 3 boards that were kind of connected, that had to be connected together. So I had wires running around there. You know, I got to this point where it was just a big mess. Now, in this case, using the Pi Pico, I was able to, as a prototype, I used that to drive the data bus and I got the chip to actually boot. And so I got it to a prompt, and that was like the first major milestone of the project, because that was when I finally realized, okay, the Mega 2 may actually be a fully functional chip. And so yeah, that's when I was like, okay, now it's time to get serious and design something more custom, because the Flywire project was not fun to debug.
Out of curiosity, what's the time frame at this point? Are you a year in? Are you a month in?
Yeah. So I got this idea 5-6 years ago. So I decided, and I don't remember the dates now, but I decided like in, say, February of 21, I wanted to finally do this project. And then by July of 21, I got the chip to boot.
Nice.
And so it was... That's why I must have the dates wrong, because I remember it being 6 months, but I also remember it was like right at the end of winter is when I said, okay, it's time to do this project.
Did you submit an errata to Apple to update their documentation about the Mega 2 at that point?
Well, I'm so glad you brought that up, Parker, because so there is no data sheet for the Mega 2. I cannot find anything. Now, there was a follow-on chip called Gemini that got used in a different product, but Gemini is in a different package and it has a couple of different functions, and it has a feature that the Mega 2 does not have. And so it's not, and it's like some people have said, oh, that's just the Mega 2. It's not. It's clearly an iteration, but it's not the exact same chip. I do have a board design document for that chip, which at least helped identify a couple of signals that I wasn't entirely sure what their purpose was, but there is no data sheet for the Mega 2. I can't find anything in any of the documentation that people have from Apple. I even emailed Team Woz asking to see if there was someone there that could help me find something. And the worst part was I was talking to a friend of mine. He works at Apple, and he's like, you know, we have this internal database with all of our code names. I could just type Mega 2 in and find out if there's anything in there. And I was like, okay, would you? He's like, no. He's like, there's no way, because he's like, I don't want to get in trouble because you're going to make a video about this. And then somebody's going to be like, wait a minute, how did he get that data sheet? I was like, oh my God. So it was just like, you got to be kidding me.
So did you end up making your own data sheet out of this?
You know, that was one of my goals, and I never did. I do have a lot of notes about the chip, but yeah. After I found the Gemini, that was the follow-on. After I found its data sheet or design document, I was less interested in doing it because a lot of the function, like the pins are at least described in that document, even if, you know, it also describes pins that Mega 2 doesn't have, but who cares? So
how close are we talking about the difference between the Gemini and the Mega? Are we talking 90% different or 98% different?
It's probably the opposite. It's probably like 10 to 20% different. Okay. There is at least 4 years between them. And so the major thing that they did with the Gemini was to make it enter. So the Gemini goes into something called the Apple II expansion card, which plugs into the LC series Macintosh, which allows it to emulate or allows it to run Apple II software. And on that card, there is the Gemini, a 65 CO2, a RAM. There is no ROM. The ROM comes from the Macintosh. And then there's a disk controller, another chip that we'll talk about, and a 558 for the joystick.
It's its own computer on a card at that point.
No, that's exactly what I was about to say. Like it's what you're designing effectively, or what you were.
Well, and yeah, it is. Yeah, actually, so we'll jump ahead. So I actually, and before I realized that I don't think I realized the IWM was built into the expansion board, but I was like, when I was designing mine, I wanted the IWM. The IWM is a chip version of the disk to the floppy disk controller card. I knew going into this that I wanted that to be part of the design because I think it would be silly to have a card. And then yeah, so then the only thing that I was kind of left wondering was why they use this other chip called Slot Maker. And that puzzled me for a really long time until I got to my second version of the project. And that's when I found out that there's a keyboard signal that comes from the chip called Slot Maker for some reason. The keyboard accesses have nothing to do with the slots. Slot Maker doesn't decode anything. I think the engineers ran out of pins on Mega 2. And they're like, okay, well, we'll just have Slot Maker generate this signal because it's connected to Mega 2 over a multiplex bus. I can't figure out any reason why you have to have Slot Maker to use the keyboard. I'm sorry, I jumped ahead a little bit there. So there's three control signals that you have to decode to know when to drive the data bus for keyboard access. And one of those signals comes from the Slot Maker. The other two come from Mega 2. So in addition to the RAM, ROM, CPU, and keyboard controller, you also have to have another ASIC called Slot Maker to make the single chip Apple IIe work.
So, okay, I guess I'm a little bit confused. Educate me on what is Slot Maker?
So Slot Maker's real purpose was in the Apple II GS. So the Apple II GS was, like I said, it was a 16-bit Apple II, but its big thing is that it had all of the major peripherals integrated. And so it had a serial controller, it had two serial controllers, one used for networking, the disk drive controller, and a couple of other things. And so generally in an Apple IIe, you would put cards into the slots, into its expansion slots for all of those functions. And so the 2GS, it had most of those things built in, but it also had physical slots. And so Slot Maker allowed the computer to either use the internal slot, the internal device, or the slot for, say, the disk controller. You could put in a custom disk controller and disable the onboard one. And so that was its real purpose, was to decide which devices were used in the 2GS.
This was like a multiplexer then.
Yeah, and it also buffered the clocks because there was I'm actually planning to look at this on a scope because it actually has to shift the clock a little bit, or most of the clocks a little bit, so that the timing lines up, because of the way, it's something to do with the way the 2GS is designed. But it basically buffers the clocks for the slots so that they get the timing that an Apple II card would expect.
I'm cringing a little bit as you're talking about all of this, just because having to discover or having to dig through all of this information, not knowing that you need this one line to be asserted or whatever.
Right.
Having done things similar to that in the past, I just know that takes tons of brain power to just sit and go, why is this not working? What am I missing here?
Well, and actually, it's funny because, so, okay, once I figured out what was going on with those keyboards, so I totally agree. Once I figured out what was going on with those keyboard signals, then it's like, okay, I got the keyboard working relatively fast after that. And then it was like, okay, now I want to try, since I had to have slot maker, I'm like, okay, now I'm going to have a slot. So I plugged in a disk card, and then it was like 2-3 weeks trying to figure out how to get the Mega 2 to talk to the slot, because the Apple IIe ROM doesn't know how to tell Mega 2 to talk to slot maker. And so I ended up finding that there's this, so there's something in the Apple II design called soft switches. It's basically in the C address space, pretty much every address changes something in the computer. So that's like the most obvious example is if you want to go from text to graphics mode, you hit, I think it's C068, and then the graphics mode changes. So there was a C switch that I found in a document of all of the C switches. There's this one for slot maker on the 2GS. And I was like, I wonder if I can use that. And it turned out that that C switch or soft switch, I call them C switches for some reason, would actually, Mega 2 would talk to slot maker and then tell slot maker to use to change the multiplex signal. But that took me 2 weeks to find, because who could I ask, right? Who would have ever, like, I didn't even know how to form that question, because it's like, I don't know what to do here. And so once I got the disk drive working, at this stage, I built what I called Rev2, which was a backplane. And the backplane had cards that plugged into it. And the idea was I took each block of the Apple II design and made them their own card so that I could basically bring up the system one block at a time. And so I got the keyboard to work, and then I got the disk drive to work. And then I built a card. So I got it with an actual disk 2 card. And then I built a card based on the IWM, and I got that working. After that point, the Rev2 stuff was, I mean, I probably spent another 6 months or so, well, 6 months total. So at that point, I would have spent 3 or 4 months working with the Rev2, like trying to figure out how stuff works. But like, I didn't hit any major roadblocks. At that point, everything was just like, it was just like, okay, well, I've got to find the address for this function. What would it be, right? But there weren't any major like, oh gosh, this will never happen. In fact, it was actually a relatively smooth process once I was able to read from disks. By about this point now, we're about a year and a half, a year to year and a half into the project.
I have to commend your persistence with just saying this is going to happen.
You know, it's funny. So I didn't mention this here, but so this was all during, you know, the 2021 timeframe, 2021, 2022. And so during the lockdown stuff, I started live streaming 3 days a week. And when I decided to work on this project, I basically for 12 to 15 hours a week, I worked on this project. And I think of all of the skills I learned, the one that I found most interesting is as I got farther into the project, I got really good at picking milestones that I could accomplish in 4-hour blocks.
Oh, that's cool.
There were just so many times where I'm like, okay, today's stream, we're going to try to solve this. And if I didn't get it on that stream, I got it by the end of the next stream, that kind of thing. It was just like, I wish this was a skill I could explain, because I think we could all benefit from it. But it's like,
yeah, I was about to say, I wish I
mean organization.
But I just started to get really good about, okay, this, I need this much time to get this much to work. But also that was, now I think about it, now I say that, that was also during the time frame where I stopped running into major issues. So that's probably a bigger aspect of it, right? Is like, just like any project, I could better, I knew more about, I no longer didn't know what I didn't know.
And something else to mention, I watched your video that's on YouTube about this on that backplane board where you could slot in all the different functions. You had a header for an analog discovery DLA that just sniffs all the lines. That is brilliant. That is absolutely fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you recall, I said in the first kind of the first bring up, I had these three boards connected together. I had an analog discovery and a digital discovery plugged in at the same time. And I mean, I'll put a picture so we can put it up in the forum. It was just literally a ball of wire, right? And when I was looking at it, I'm like, most of those wires are the logic analyzer. So what can I do to get rid of those connections? And so when I laid out the backplane, I'm like, why don't I just make it so I can plug the, so it was a digital discovery. Why don't I just make it so I can just plug it directly in? And so it plugs in, and all 16 of the address and all 8 bits of the data lines go directly in. And so then I have to, then I have fly wires for the clocks or like control signals or whatever. But I think I said this in the video, of everything I figured out in this project, that has been, I think that was the most clever thing I did, because it just, it, I mean, anyone that's ever used a logic analyzer, you know that it's a bad day when you have to start hooking it up, right? Because you can't figure out what's going on. It's a pain in the ass to plug in. And then you have to figure out how to trigger on the thing you need. You know, it's just, it's not, no one's having a good day. And this was the exact opposite experience. Like, it's like, I pretty much just, it was like, took me seconds to open up waveforms and hit run and see whatever I needed to see. Yeah, that was, I'm still very, very happy about that.
Yeah, big thumbs up on that one. Yeah, I guarantee if I ever have a project like this, I'm going to copy that.
You know what's really funny about that is, wow, a couple weeks ago, Stephen, we had Brendan on talk about continuous integration and development.
Yeah.
That's in line with that kind of style, is build your tools into your prototypes, so to speak.
Yeah, actually, and this was, and I didn't make a big deal about this here, but that, when I came up with this Rev2 concept, a lot of people look at the back plane and they're like, oh, so you want to be able to plug in cards. It's like, well, not really. What I wanted was, I wanted a hardware development platform for the Apple II, or in this case, the Mega II. And it was stuff like that. It's like, yeah, why don't I build in the logic analyzer? If I had to do it again, I would also build in, and I don't know how I would do this, but I didn't like how I did the power. I would have liked to been able to make better power measurements and have better control of the power rails, instead of just like, I just had like a header pin that I connect the logic in, or the power supply to. I would have liked to have like a sense resistor and maybe some fuses or something, just to get a little better idea of what's going on without having to have a, you know, a DMM or something.
Well, it's very clearly designed with debugging and engineering in mind, because you basically made a dev kit for the Apple II.
Yeah. Yeah.
Love it.
Yeah. I've actually thought about like doing a design like that for the actual Apple IIe, because that's something that more people will have access to. Because kind of going back to, you know, the stuff is all open, but it's like, how do you get a probe on the clock? Right. Mm-hmm. That's kind of a pain.
All right. So in terms of what's next, so we've got something bootable and we have something that you can interact with. What happens next?
Yeah. So more or less, the next major thing I did was I wanted to figure out how to handle video. I didn't want to have a composite video signal, which is what the 2GS has. And so I won't get into how the Apple II video works, because I don't fully understand it. But what I'll say is there's a signal called serial video, and it's basically a single line of luminance information for a CRT. And so it gets combined with a sync pulse, and then that's how the computer basically draws your screen image. The Mega II has that serial video signal, which you can basically frame up and use. However, the color information is, it's all kind of phase encoded, and trying to determine where those edges are with, say, like pretty much anything is just a nightmare. However, the Mega II also has a group of signals called RGB, which there's 4 bits for RGB, and it's a 16. It's basically a lookup table for the 16 colors of the Apple II palette. And so what's really cool about the Mega II is it always outputs in the Apple II's highest resolution mode, but it emulates the lower resolution modes. And so the reason I bring this up is because one of the most characteristic things about the Apple II is that, because of the way it generates video, there's these ringing effects, which are artifacts from basically NTSC and the way that it generates color. And so like, if you look at a Apple II screen in graphics mode, white will always have like a blue and red fringe on it. And it's because of the way the color gets generated. Well, the Mega II generates its video entirely digitally. And so those fringing effects don't actually occur. And so the Mega II actually generates them internally. It actually generates what should be fringing effects, so that when you look at its output, it looks like what an Apple II would, even though it's entirely digital.
So wait, it's emulating it?
That baffles my mind why they did that.
Okay. So I just want to be clear, Parker, which part baffles you?
Oh, no. The fact that they designed the circuitry to produce those fringe effects in their silicon.
Yeah.
Instead of having a crisper line or anything like that.
So I do wonder if there's a soft switch that I can hit to turn it off. you know, I don't know how it was implemented. So maybe it's not, maybe it's like part of like the shift register when it comes out or something. I don't know. But I wonder if there's a way to turn it off. I do know there is a video mode that the 2E does not have, but the 2GS supports because the Mega 2 does it. And it's like, it's called double high res monochrome. And it looks gorgeous. It's like, it's basically an EGA level of resolution. But frankly, I think they had to do it because so much software and so many games relied on it for their to make the graphics look the way they wanted them to look. Without it, things would look weird. And keep in mind, it only happens when you're in color modes. So like if you're in a monochrome mode, it's perfectly clear.
Yeah. I remember back when I was doing Atari video mods and the luminosity is all digital and the color comes out at, you were talking about the phase change, that's chroma, which is part of the NTSC standard.
Yep.
And like Atari 2600 just generates that out of the chip. So you don't actually get color digitally, but you get the luminosity is digital. So you can,
okay.
So when you, if you combine everything right, you actually get really crisp black and white, but then you kind of have to fuzz mm-hmm. the chroma so that it still looks clearer than what would be like on a composite image. But
yeah,
there was no way to do like a HDMI output from Atari without having to do like a frame buffer, basically.
So speaking of doing a frame buffer. So basically what I looked at is like, okay, so the Mega 2 outputs these, it basically outputs each pixel of data on this 4-bit bus. And I'm like, okay, well, that gets clocked at like 14 megahertz. And so I was like, okay, well, I can use another PIO to capture that data. And then basically what I did was I captured the data as it comes out, I frame it up, and then I dumped it into a, I guess a frame buffer that then on the RP2040, that some software that I found called Pico VGA, it takes that frame of data and then it uses another PIO to output VGA. And so I thought that was going to be the most complicated part of the entire project. And I think it took like 2 weeks to capture the data and then figure out how to decode it and start outputting. I was actually shocked at how fast that I got that to work. And then by this point, this was about the 20th circuit board I had designed. Mm. And it was the first and only one that came up with no problems.
Nice.
You know, hearing that you can use an RP2040 that way is, I need to start looking into that more, because back when I was doing all that other stuff was you had to use an FPGA to do the capturing of the signals, building up a frame buffer, mm-hmm. and then let's say outputting VGA. I spent probably double of 2 weeks just compiling Verilog code to get my stuff to work. Because <Yeah. laughs> you change one thing and then it's like 15 minutes of fitting functions for the output onto your FPGA.
Yeah, it's always the part where it actually takes forever.
Yeah.
I mean, I got lucky because I had that basically a lookup table. I basically got the pixel data from Mega 2. If I had to look at the video signal, the Lumen Chroma signal, I don't know that I could have done that with an RP2040. Maybe, but I have a feeling that would have been, I think I would have needed something to decelerate that, which is what the Mega 2 is actually doing. And so, yeah, so then at that point I had in the Rev 2 form factor, I had a fully functional Apple II. It was really exciting. I thought about stopping the project right there because it's like, it works. I still use it. I actually like the Rev 2 design. It's kind of it's a beast, but it's so robust. But yeah, so then I was like, all right, well, I always wanted to make, well, originally I wanted to make a portable Apple II, but I became less and less interested in that. And then it was just like, okay, I want to make a miniature Apple IIe. And so of course the next step was take everything that I had built, which I mean, altogether was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, about 8 circuit boards and combine it all into one, which then became what I call Rev 3.
So Rev 3 is finally the single board computer that you originally sought out for.
Yep.
Very cool.
Yeah. So it has all of the, it basically has everything I need to do everything we've talked about. It has its own switch mode power supply. I borrowed an idea from the Apple IIc where there's like a slot in the IIc and the power supply plugs into the slot. I kind of just like that, which I'm glad I did it that way because my first power supply was terrible. It had like 8 volt. It was 8 volts peak to peak on the 5 volt rail, or the 5 volt rail went to 8 volts peak. And then, so it was 4 volts peak to peak, 3 volts peak to peak on top of the 5 volt rail. So I was really glad that I didn't have to respin an entire four-layer board just to change the power supply.
Yep.
And then I wasn't going to put a slot, but having the slot in Rev 2 was so helpful that I decided I might as well put one slot in it. And on that one, I actually have dip switches so I can assign which slot it actually appears as. Mm. But yeah, so it's got like a modern 65 CO2, 128K RAM, the Mega 2, an IWM for the disk drive, slot maker because
you have
got to have that. And then there's two RP2040s. One does the keyboard stuff, and it's also it's kind of a PMIC. It monitors the rail, and then it brings up the Apple II stuff once it's happy. And then there's another RP2040 doing the VGA output.
So now you can Apple II on the plane now, right? Is that where we're at?
Pretty much. It doesn't have a screen. See, originally I was going to build a screen into it. And instead what I did was on GrabCAD, I found a Apple IIe model, which was a very good looking replica, much better than the one I drew, but it wasn't a real model. It was just faces. And so I had to modify it so that it could actually be printed. And so I did that. And I was just like, I just kind of started down that path. So I started looking at this as a miniature Apple IIe, and I just kind of went right down that path and said, okay, I'm going to make this into a miniature Apple IIe.
So now that you have this all thrown together, what's the future of it? Or is it time to wash your hands and say, this project is done?
Yeah. So here's the little secret that isn't obvious in the video. I was so burned out. So let me just mention it. The Rev 3 has a ton of problems. I screwed up the EEPROM and it took me a long time to get the thing to boot. And then there's a couple of other issues that I ran into that just weren't even related to design problems. But it was an absolute nightmare getting this thing up and running. And so by the time I got the board to work, I was like, okay, now I'm supposed to make a video about it. I'm like, I'm just going to put this down and come back to it next month. And then a year went by. There's a year gap from when I was done to when I made the video.
Nice.
So when's Rev 4?
You just had to, didn't you, Parker?
Yeah. So you know what I want to do on Rev 4 is I don't want to solder it.
Yeah, you're all good. It sounds like it's getting crazy over there.
Yeah, I just got to notice that there's a severe storm coming through. Yeah, so Rev 4, I actually want to use Rev 4. All right, we're just going to have to live with it.
Yeah,
yeah.
Sorry, there's a storm going on. So no joke, Parker, I actually want to use assembly service for Rev 4 because I do not want to assemble all of the off-the-shelf stuff on another board. That was not a fun experience. It's too big.
I'll see what I can do on my end.
Wink, wink, hint, hint. Yeah. I'll
see what I do. Oh, you understood what I was getting at.
So are all the files available for people to look at and dig through?
Yeah, absolutely. So I've got a GitHub repo. I'll give you guys a link to put on the forum. Everything I did is up there, including the including the case files as well. But yeah, everything is there. I saw no reason to hide any of it.
Before we wrap up, so when 3/5 years ago, how long did you think it would actually take you to do this?
Seriously, honestly, frankly, I thought I was looking at a month to month and a half. But, you know, so I went to a conference for Apple II users, and the joke title I used there was how I built the Mega 2 and accidentally reverse engineered the Apple II computer because I didn't realize how much I was going to have to learn about the computer in order to use this chip. And in retrospect, I don't know what I was thinking. I really did think I was just going to be able to hook up RAM, ROM, and CPU and have a computer.
I really hope the engineer that wrote that documentation that said, oh yeah, just put the RAM, add RAM and a power supply and you got this thing working. I really hope that engineer is still out there and watches that video and goes, ah, I should have, I had that amendment that gotcha, but it didn't get approved. So it didn't make the documentation.
Yeah. They forgot to add the footnote. Yeah. I mean, yeah, at the end of the day, the Mega 2 chip is an Apple IIe's logic, but That is it. It's just the Apple IIe's logic. And in fact, there's a handful of things that are slightly different from the 2E. So it's not even truly like somebody asked me, could you make a drop-in replacement for the 2E chipset? You know, it'd be really clunky looking, but I don't think you can, because like the way it handles the keyboard is different. You'd have to add glue logic in order for the keyboard to work correctly. So it's, but for the most part, yeah, it is what they said it was, but there was a little exaggeration in, on how it worked.
The other 40 pages of documentation just was not after it.
Yeah.
So
whoops.
And that's not something you can go look up. You had to stumble through all of that, which yeah. I don't know. I think that's absolutely fascinating.
So before we let you go, James, what is going to be the next 2-month project that actually ends up being 3-5 years?
I'm not even.
Not even going to look. Not even thinking about it yet.
Yeah, so
the wounds have to heal.
I'm being very cautious about getting into something like this again. And to seriously answer the question, I'm looking into a lot of machine learning stuff right now for edge devices. And so I'm going to go completely the opposite direction of retro stuff and start dealing with modern things, at least for a little while. After I make Rev 4.
To actually finish the project. Call it what we say at work, done.
Done.
You've hit the first done. You need the second done. So for all of our listeners, there's a really great YouTube video that goes into a little bit more details of this, and you get to see all of James's boards. It's on the Element 14 Presents YouTube channel.
Yeah, I'll give you guys some links. There's 3 videos in total for the Mega 2. So there was the first video, getting to the boot, this final video, and then there was a talk I did at a conference called Kansas Fest, which is an annual conference for Apple II users. It was kind of in the middle.
Awesome.
Well, again, thank you so much, James, for joining us. For those who want to know more about James, visit baldengineer.com, which is kind of his website that combines everything that he works on. Because I went there today, James, and you've got like 4 or 5 different... It's like an umbrella website because you got like 4 or 5 different things going on.
Yeah, I try to make it look kind of like my link tree. So it's like everything I'm doing, I just put there.
Yeah.
I used to regularly write on it, but now it's just kind of like, here's everything I'm doing.
But we'll have that link in our show notes. And I guess that's going to be the end of this podcast. Thank you so much, James.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, guys. It's been a blast.
Thank you for listening to Circuit Break. We're your hosts, Parker Dolman.
And Stephen Craig.
Later, everyone.
Take it easy.
Thank you, yes, you, our listener, for downloading our podcast. Tell your friends and coworkers about Circuit Break, the podcast for Macrofab. If you have a cool idea, project, or topic you want us to discuss, let Stephen and I and the community know. Our community, where you can find personal projects, discussions about the podcast, and engineering topics and news, is located at forum.macrofab.com.